Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
I am so excited to be here with co-founder of Crooked Media, co-host of Pod Saves America, that little show you may have heard of, and now host of a new series called Offline, John Favreau. Hi, John.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
So happy. I mean, I left out of your introduction the most important thing of all, that you are Emily's husband and dad of Charlie, who I believe is the first boy that my daughter has ever met. And I
think
it's true. And if marriage still exists in 30 years, which jury's still out, that would be a very cute beat cute, I have to say.
I think that'll be perfect. I think it's so funny that this is the first time you and I are really chatting, even though you've been in my backyard with your child.
This is sort
it shows
of modern
you how much I work.
Parenting. Yes, exactly right. Well, it's fitting that this is our first official conversation, because this is something that I hear you talk about all the time. I listen to you talk about all the time, and it's something that I am never shutting up about. I'm so glad that you're talking about this in Offline. For those people who haven't heard the new series yet, can you just tell us a little bit about what you're digging into and why you started to dig into it? And then I'll have about a million things that I want to ask you about it.
Yes, for sure. So this is a series, it's an interview series about all the ways that the internet is breaking our brain and what we can do about it. And I wanted to talk to people in all different fields, not just politics and media, but sports, comedy, entertainment, business, et cetera. And, you know, look, the internet being annoying is not necessarily like a new idea, but I wanted to do the show for two reasons, one personal and one broader. Personal, I found myself during the pandemic, like everyone else, online all the time, even more. That little notification on your phone that tells you like how long you've been online each week, mm-hmm. how long you've been using the phone, like it would go up every single week during the pandemic. And I started thinking that like all the reasons the internet was bad were sort of amplified by the fact that we were having more contact with people and mostly strangers online, and less contact with the people in our real lives because we were all stuck inside. And I started feeling like it was making me a little bit crazier. Mm. And then obviously the country has been through some shit in the last couple of years. But thinking about the fact that we all went through a pandemic, a very divisive election, which then turned into an insurrection, the protests following George Floyd's murder, right? Like all of these gigantic things we went through mostly online. And I don't think it helped. In fact, I thought it hurt quite a bit that we were doing this all online. And so my sort of running thesis was that, like, you know, this project of democracy is difficult under the best possible circumstances when there's just 300 million plus people trying to live and work together in relative peace and prosperity. Sort of on our own, by shutting everyone inside and making us just interact mainly online with each other through these platforms, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, or anything else, Facebook, it's made the project that much harder. So for my own like personal sanity, and I think the sanity of the Republic, I thought we should talk about this more. And I should interview more people about it more, because it's sort of that thing in the background that we're complaining about here and there, but I don't know that we have sufficiently examined it beyond what we see in the headlines about Facebook or disinformation or all that kind of stuff, because I think the real problems go much deeper than that.
I agree with you. And I think obviously everything was exacerbated during the pandemic and made worse and certainly made more online. That was our only means of interaction and connection and experiencing anything beyond the four walls within which we all live. But I feel like things got worse on the internet during the Trump administration. That's obviously the easiest thing I could possibly say. But I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg scenario, and I'm wondering if you have an opinion on it. I don't know if the internet became a hellscape because of Trump, or Trump became what Trump was because of the internet hellscape. I feel like it's a little bit of a vicious cycle.
It's such a great question. The first person I interviewed for the series is Gia Tolentino, who wrote Trick Mirror, a collection of essays, many of which are about the internet and how the internet is breaking our brains. This is why I wanted to interview her first. And I was trying to ask her this question too, like, when did the internet go bad? And we both started talking about how, like, I can remember in, you know, I was on the Obama campaign in 2008, and the internet was good. Organizing online was good. It helped us win the election. Everything was wonderful. I think that by the 2012 reelect, Twitter had started becoming quite annoying, because Twitter basically was the assignment editor for the political media. And I remember contending with that. But I also think, like, so I left the White House in 2013, and I had been a Twitter lurker before then. I had a Twitter account, but I wasn't allowed to tweet because I was a White House employee. And when I left in 2013, I was like, well, now I'm going to finally say what's on my mind, you know, and
you're freed.
I'm freed. So I like fire off tweets and get in arguments with Republicans on Twitter. And like, it was, I guess, cathartic for a little bit, mildly amusing, but it quickly became sort of annoying, I thought. And then Trump started running. Then the 2016 election happened. And I do think that once Trump won, the beginning months after that, I think the internet and specifically Twitter was okay, because I ended up like meeting a lot of people I wouldn't have otherwise met, who were all in the same place, whether you were like someone on the center right or someone from the far left. Everyone was like, okay, Trump is president. We'd all need to figure out a way to work together to beat this guy, to stop this threat. And there was a lot of organizing and conversation that happened because of, I think, specifically Twitter, that I think was helpful. It soon got a little bit crazy. Like, I do think that, to your question about the chicken or egg thing, like, Trump in some ways is the perfect internet candidate, right? Like, you know, one complaint about Twitter is that it strips away context, it strips away nuance, it doesn't allow for sort of thoughtful debate. It causes us to overvalue our own opinions. Like, all of these things are characteristics of Donald Trump.
That's exactly right.
You know, like, he is the, I used to say about him that he is like a cable TV addict who became president. Right? Like, he is the guy who just yelled shit at the television all day long. But I think the internet in many ways supercharges that phenomenon of like watching cable television, because it is faster. It is even shorter than what you see on cable TV, and it is even angrier, nastier, because unlike cable TV, you can interact with it instead of just watch it passively. And I think that, like, when you throw Trump into that equation, it just makes it all worse.
I think you're exactly right. And I think that what you hit on is, you know, Trump was obviously addicted to cable news, but he made everyone else in the country addicted to both cable and to Twitter. And I think that I can only speak to this personally as a reporter, and I think you are probably in the same boat. We're two of the very few people in this country who could say that professionally we needed to be very online over the last 6 years. And I think that I used it as an excuse, or at least my brain was able to lean on that. And really, I think I was just addicted. I felt like I had to be the most informed. I had to read every take. I had to read every tweet, just constantly be checking my phone in order to be informed in case I was asked about them or I had to talk about them to a source. And I'm sure you feel like, you know, you guys are recording constantly and have to know everything on everything. But in reality, had a child 4.5 months ago, and I really stopped checking Twitter, like, completely. And I realize I was addicted, and it was not totally serving me in any way, shape, or form. I just couldn't help myself. And I think that the country writ large was addicted to news and addicted to consumption of news over the last 6 years in an insanely unhealthy way.
A very unhealthy way. And I think, and you're right. I mean, for I did the same thing as you. I told myself that it was my job. I record a podcast twice a week. And even if that wasn't my job, I, as a Democrat and a strategist, an activist, an organizer, whatever, wanted to figure out how to beat Donald Trump. I thought it was important to me personally. I thought it was important to the country, even if I didn't have this job. And so I told myself that that's why I'm online. But you soon start realizing that we are hit every day with a flood of information, much of it bad, much of it things that we cannot do anything about.
Yes.
You know, and I think we can do a lot about a lot of things, right? I advocate political organizing and advocacy and all of that stuff. But not every bad headline or offensive tweet or mean tweet or something that Donald Trump says is something that we can actually affect change over, right?
Yes.
And I don't think we can sort of tell the difference anymore. Mm. And I think that's a real problem because, you know, there was this thing that the resistance types would say during the Trump years where it's like, he's trying to distract us from X or Y. And like, I don't think Donald Trump's that smart to distract people. But it's true that as a country, we are perpetually distracted all the time because of the flood of information we're getting through these platforms.
It's not just the flood of information, too. It's like it's a flood of takes. And I thought I listened to all the episodes of Offline that exists right now. I'm excited to hear more. But you spoke to Peter Hamby, who is a former colleague of mine, doubly, both at Vanity Fair and at CNN. And he's now at Snapchat running news. And I think that you guys hit on the fact that there's so much, I'm going to call it take-based journalism on Twitter, that you're not only getting so much of it, but you're getting so much of a spin on it that it's not really helpful to anybody.
It's not. And because also it, you know, and Gia talks about the, one of the problems with the internet is it causes us to overvalue our opinions and our takes. And someone tweeted a couple weeks ago, like, hey, for those of you who tweet about politics, serious question, I'm not trying to be snarky. Why do you do it? What is your purpose?
Mm.
And it really made me think because I was like, I don't know. What am I trying to do?
What is your answer to that? If you were to respond to that tweet, which would be an insane thing for you to do, but if you were to respond to it, what would you have said?
So I thought about it for a while and my answer was, okay, what's useful for me to tweet is information about politics that may help people get involved that they wouldn't otherwise get.
Right.
I can amplify interesting stories that I think people would enjoy or that might help people think about politics and maybe the way that I want them to think about it that they might not get on their own. Or I'm actually trying to persuade people. And when I say trying to persuade people, it's not like I'm trying. I don't think like a tweet of mine is going to cause a Trump voter to be like, oh, I'm going to become a Democrat now. But as a former Democratic strategist, Democratic staffer, I think there are certain messages that the Democratic Party could disseminate that are more effective than others. There are certain strategies that might be more effective than others. So, okay, so maybe I'll tweet about that. But then, but those aren't the only things I tweet about. Now, look, I can tweet jokes once in a while. I think that's fine and harmless, whatever. But like, it made me think a lot about the slams or like highlighting some Republican who said something bad or did something bad. Like, if I'm just tweeting about that, like, what is that tweet actually doing? Like, okay, I pointed out that Ted Cruz is an asshole. Great. What did that change?
Sure. Well, I think that you're getting into another episode of yours. You had Monica Lewinsky on, who personally I adore her as a friend and love her as a colleague in our Vanity Fair family. And the episode was, I think, Monica at her best talking about a subject she obviously knows a great deal about, and that's public shaming. And I think that the internet is sort of this perfect storm of a place where you have anonymity, you have both media and social media pushing you towards things that are the most base level bad, and you have people who are just meaner to a screen than they would be in person. And I think, you know, you saying dunking on a Republican on Twitter is not because you're a mean person, but those kinds of things are very easy to do online. And I don't know that they have a positive outcome. And I don't think that online you need to have a positive effect in order to share it. I actually think it's the opposite. There's way more of a reason to have a negative effect in the world online. It's incentivized, in fact.
I mean, I am like maybe one of the least confrontational people mm-hmm. I know, sometimes to a fault, I've been told. So the idea that like I half the shit that I tweet, the idea that I would say that to the person's face if I met them is crazy. like even if I have Republican family members, you know, and back in the day when we used to travel and see people, mm-hmm. I would see them for holidays and they would start talking to me about politics. And I would usually try to steer the conversation towards something else. Like I wouldn't yell at them. I wouldn't get in big fights at the dinner table. I'd like calmly try to tell them why I disagree. And I've tried to persuade them that they're wrong, but I would do so in like a very respectful and polite way, or try to make jokes, even though they're my relatives and I know them really well, or friends, you know? So the idea that if I like saw a random Republican on the street, like you do on Twitter, I would start yelling at them or getting in a fight with them over something is silly to me. Like that's not how I would act in person, but yet that's how we all act online all the time.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Well, what's interesting about that is that I think you're totally right. The way that we act on the internet has had no relation to the way we act in person. And I am in the midst of sort of writing a story about this, so I think a lot about online shaming. And there's this feminist who wrote in the 70s about like the consequences of shaming people publicly. And mm-hmm. and obviously there was no Twitter when she was writing this story or this article. And she was extolling all the ways in which there are personal consequences to you as the shamer if you are calling somebody out in person, and you lose all of that personal consequence. But I think that for the first time last January, we sort of saw what happens on the internet turn into behavior in real life, and we saw it in a very consequential way in Washington. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how we're starting to see online terrible, hateful behavior translate into real world behavior in a real and very scary way.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously we saw it on January 6th, but even since then, you know, some of this I think is pandemic related. There's a lot of rage that was built up during the pandemic for a host of different reasons. But all those stories about people being nasty to flight attendants on planes or other passengers at sporting events, people, you know, it's just like people are getting nastier and meaner in real life. And I don't know if, you know, some people could say, well, that's always been the case. It's just that we know about it more because of the internet. And so these things go viral. But I don't know. Like, I kind of think that, you know, if most of the social human interactions we have are on these platforms that encourage our worst impulses, then of course it's going to bleed into real life. Of course, when we are stressed out from, you know, being stuck in our homes for a year and a half, we're going to have a shorter temper when someone cuts in front of us driving, or we're on an airplane and, you know, we've been waiting for 5 hours to take off and stuff like that. Like, I do think the more time we spend online, the more it can easily blur the line between online world and real world. And there aren't a lot of spaces where just like meeting strangers or acquaintances one-on-one without all of the algorithms pushing us one way or the other, and just sort of like debating peacefully or just getting to know each other or hashing out our differences, you know, like that's part of the issue too, I think.
Well, when you're not taking the moment on the internet anymore, when you're removing that second pause online between when you think something and when you write something on the internet, when you've removed that impulse
from your day-to-day habits on the internet, it's hard to then say, okay, but I'm not going to remove that impulse in person. Your brain is just reconfigured at that point. And I think we've lost the ability to take a pause both on the internet and in real life. And I think that that pause is so vital. And I am worried that we've gone past a point where that pause is just like, we don't get it back anymore because of the way the internet has just completely reshaped our neural tubes or whatever it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm interviewing Charlie Warzel in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about Facebook and everything, but something he wrote about Facebook stuck with me, which is like, you can change the platform all you want. You can tweak the algorithms. We can break up Facebook. We can do all these things. But like, we are now so enmeshed in these platforms and they have probably changed and rewired our brain so much that like absent platforms, like you just said, it may have rewired us. It may have changed our behavior. And that, like if you've ever done sort of a technology detox, right? If you ever put your phone down for a while, even for a short while, it's hard. Like you find yourself checking your pocket for your phone. You find yourself sometimes like a little distracted, a little agitated. Like you just like need that dopamine hit of new information. What's going on? I'm looking for an alert, you know, like it's really bad.
It is. And I will say like, so I had a kid and I did not check the news for like weeks, maybe. I definitely did not open Twitter. And when I started sort of emerging from a cocoon, I now use Twitter in a completely different way. And I think it makes me, I used to think not knowing everything, every tweet, every take, every story that was a thing on Twitter would make me a worse reporter. And I think now the way in which I use Twitter makes me a better reporter. I'll tell you why, and you tell me if you think this is crazy, as now I'm going to dub an expert of the internet.
Perfect.
I use it way more intentionally. I maybe scroll for like 3 minutes a day maximum, just scroll, see what people are talking about. That's a high number for me now. But I use it very intentionally. Like if I will go and read a story on the New York Times or obviously Vanity Fair or The Atlantic or whatever, and I want to know more about that story, or I'm watching something on TV and I want to know what other people are saying about that thing that I'm watching on TV, I intentionally look for one specific thing and see what people are saying about that one specific thing. And then I'm out. I'm not looking aimlessly at Twitter anymore, which is what I used to spend hours doing every day. And I feel like not knowing what everyone is, what all the takes are on Twitter, makes me more like most people in this country. It doesn't make me more like people in Washington or New York or Los Angeles or all the places that I've lived. It makes me more like a normal in this country. And I think understanding how a normal perceives what is important is a much more valuable thing as a journalist than knowing every single thing that everyone in New York or Washington or Los Angeles is talking about online. Does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense. I could not agree more. I mean, I had a slightly different experience, though, similar in ways. Like, you know, when Charlie was born in July, it was unexpected that we were going to have a kid during the election, even before the pandemic, because yes. I was like, I'm going to be incredibly busy during the election. I'm worried I'm not going to have enough time to be a dad if we have a child then. And so like, let's wait till after the election. Obviously that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then we're in the middle of the pandemic. And I told myself when Charlie was first born, like, it's okay. These first couple months, this is the 2020 election. Everything's on the line. And so I did not take myself away from Twitter. I buried my head in Twitter the whole time during the first months of his life. And I think I was a much worse parent and I did not bond with him the way that I should have in those early months, because I used as an excuse the fact that I needed to pay attention to the news because of the election. Mm. And I was continually agitated and I was like, I don't know about this parenthood thing and might not work out. So anyway, fast forward, the election's over. And, you know, once they become like 5, 6, 7 months and they have a personality and they're smiling at you, you know, then I spent more time with them. And
yes.
Finally, as I started spending time with him as he grew up in these like last 5 or 6 months, 7 months, I put my phone down, or I tried to put my phone down when I was spending time with him. And I found so much joy and fulfillment in hanging out with him, like without a phone around me. Mm. And then that's how it started. But then I started using it like you just talked about, which is, okay, if I'm preparing for the pod, I'm going to like look at Twitter and look at like takes on interesting articles. And I'm also going to just like read more, not books. I know that's hard for me, but at least read more like long form pieces. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it got my brain going in a different way. And I started thinking creatively again about like forming my own opinions as opposed to just like reading all of the other opinions out there and trying to like figure out a take based on other takes. Like maybe I should try to figure out my own take based on just like reading something instead of reading what like 50 fucking people had to say about the bipartisan infrastructure bill who like sit in Washington. That's not really that helpful.
I agree with you. And I also think that expanding your mind and making you a better thinker makes you a better thinker, right? You don't have to be a thinker who reads a lot of takes about the same stuff to just be a better thinker. And so you come up with a version of the world that makes more sense to you. You brought up Charlie. And so I'm going to zero in. I also think of what you're describing, the first 4 months of having a baby. It's very similar, particularly for a lot of dads that I know. It's just, it's hard for dads in the beginning, I think, in a different way that it's hard for moms.
Yeah. No one told me that. No one prepared me for that one.
Yeah. We talk about it a lot over here and, it's a very different thing. You're experiencing this in a totally different way, but I'm thinking a lot now about what the internet is going to be like for my daughter. And, you and I are sitting here bitching and moaning about all the ways it's breaking our brain. And I am terrified for the ways in which it will break her brain one day. And I'm already making decisions that I both like and don't like about her on the internet. And I don't show her face on the internet, but I have my phone around her and she's 4.5 months and I can see her being like, that thing is cool. And I cringe every single time I see that twinkle in her eye and I literally throw my phone across the room and I don't know what to do. And I'm sure you're thinking about this a lot. And I don't know if you've come up with any answers about that.
We have not, because I think it's easy to tell yourself, okay, we're going to be one of those families, like no screen time until X age. And then, as you know, when you're a parent and you're busy and you're doing a million things, you're like, okay, he wants to watch Sesame Street for 15 minutes. That's going to be fine. Or if he's going to watch something at least educational, you tell yourself that's going to be fine.
I mean, funny. I FaceTime I know you guys are like this too. Our parents aren't local. Both sets of grandparents are on the East Coast. And so we FaceTime with them every day. And I think net, it's a positive thing, but I'm like, is she just staring at the screen and that's going to be her thing? It drives me crazy every day.
Well, it's so hard. So Charlie will come into my office, and because I did this once, which was like on YouTube, I showed him an Elmo video, which he's obsessed with, and he sat on my lap. Now, every time he runs into my office and sees me while I'm working, he says, Elmo, 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 and points to the points to my laptop.
Game over. Yeah.
And like, what am I? And I feel bad. And it's like, nice cuddling with him and he sits on my lap and we do this together, but I'm like, I don't think this is good for him. And this is just passive viewing, which isn't great, but it's not even the interactive stuff that happens when they figure out like how to use a phone or the internet. And I said this to Gia during our interview too, but like just watching him run around the house, play with toys, amuse himself, distract himself with sort of non-online things, toys, books, everything else, is like such a reminder of the joy that can bring a child. And then when I watch him watching a screen, I'm like, oof, what's happening here, right? Like, is he learning anything? Is he just a zombie? Like, so we try to read to him a lot. And then even I've gone like a step further from just reading to him, because my parents did this with me all the time. I remember like, my dad would put me to bed by telling me stories and making up stories or telling me stories about his childhood and his friends. And just that act of like being creative with your child and telling them stories, I do think sort of can help maybe spark a creativity and you want to like teach your kids how to think, you know? And so I've been trying to do that a little bit more, talking to him, narrate things that I'm doing, just trying to do things that aren't like passive and looking at a screen, but it's hard.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations sparking movements and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
Speaking of being creative, and I thought about this a lot in your interview with Monica, if you think about the risk now of what the right has co-opted cancer culture as, and the left just talks about accountability culture, I caution anybody who wants to get into public life now. And I say, even if people, like, I've had friends who are up for big jobs, and I am like, well, you know what's going to happen, right? You know what's going to happen, and you should do it, and you're the right person for this job, but just be aware of what could be coming for you, and rightfully a lot of the times, and wrongfully a lot of the times. When you think about Washington, and I know that you advise people all the time or talk to people all the time who want to put their hat in the ring, who want to take on roles in public life, what role does the internet play in either convincing people into or out of taking a risk in running for office or taking a public job? And I'm wondering if you come across that in your
conversations. I think it's pushing a lot of people away. And look, this is, it's a really tough subject to talk about because, you know, the term cancel culture is now so loaded that you complain about cancel culture and, you know, it's like you're a white dude with a Substack or Barry Weiss or something like that. And you're like, oh, you know, powerful people who fuck up shouldn't be held accountable. And that's not the case. Powerful people should be held accountable. In fact, I think I talked about this with Monica. One of the things I thought about when I watched the American Crime Story impeachment and her public shaming doc as well, is I'm like, okay, well, if Twitter was around back in 1998, like maybe Bill Clinton would have been held more accountable than he was, you know, like maybe because maybe a lot of people whose voices who didn't get to have a voice back then would have been heard, like Monica or a lot of other people. Right. And maybe when those fucking late night hosts said the most horrible things about her, disgusting things about her, like, yeah, a couple of them could have used a cancellation,
of course.
You know? And so like, I do think it's good to like, that there are consequences and that the gatekeepers have fallen away so that more people have a voice, particularly marginalized communities. Like, I think that is all a good thing. But I also think we have gotten to the point where just average people, not like powerful corporations or powerful politicians, average people, you know, like we're not giving people space to make mistakes. Mm. And what worries me is someone makes a mistake, they say something bad, or they say something that reveals that they have not evolved with the culture, maybe because they're a little old, maybe because they've been protected by their privilege for a long time, right? So they say something really fucking stupid and they try to apologize and no one accepts the apology. In fact, the apology gets picked apart and everyone piles on the apology and now there's a big thing. And so we are then saying, we're not allowing people the space to make a mistake and then grow. And so what that tells other people is if you make a mistake, you shouldn't apologize because it's not really going to work anyway. So who fucking cares? And what that then does is we are selecting for, especially in public life and politics, and this is where Trump comes back in, we are selecting for the most shameless people, the people who say, if I go say something and do something offensive and people give me shit for it, it's not going to matter because I'm not going to apologize and you can't shame me and you can't make me embarrassed. So I'm going to be perfect for public life. I'm going to be perfect for politics. And all the other people who are worried about making a mistake or saying something wrong or taking a bad picture or whatever it may be, aren't going to serve because they're worried that their life's going to get picked apart by this. And like, I don't want to over-exaggerate the consequences, right? Like, you do, I have done, I have said and done things that people don't agree with and that are mad at me about, right? And what you sometimes just do is say, okay, you're mad at me. I take that criticism. Some of it I try to incorporate into my behavior and change my behavior. Some of it I don't agree with. But I try to say, I deserve that. I'm a public figure. People can say whatever they want. That part's fine. But I do think like some of the pylons are creating, or at least pushing people away from saying what they want to say, doing what they want to do, and entering public life, which is tough no matter what. But I do think we want more public servants, because a lot of the ones we have are sort of shitty.
I would say that's possibly a gross understatement. In hearing that, I think you're 100% right. And I think that there is obviously such a grave consequence to public shaming, both for people who are public people and people who are private people. And I think for anyone who wants a great listen, I would go ahead and listen to Monica talk about that with you, John. In thinking about that, coupled with the way that our brains are being reshaped, coupled with the way that journalism has sort of turned into this mess on Twitter, what's the solution here?
Yeah, no, it's the million-dollar question. I mean, look, there's a sort of policy solutions which are difficult, because now you're talking about like people legislating how to fix algorithms, which seems tricky. Yes. I think we're finally getting to the point, and I think Frances Hogan has helped us move along to this point, where the political conversation around this isn't just about free speech and who gets to, and disinformation, right? Which disinformation is obviously a huge problem, but it is more amplification than anything else. And we're sort of focused on the algorithms, right? The algorithms that prize engagement above all else and reward sort of the type of engagement that is mean and nasty and enraging and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think there's like, you know, there's some bill now where you can have like it gives people the option to have a feed that's free of algorithms, right? And so people have talked about messing with the algorithms. But again, it's tough, politically tough, because we don't really have the political will to do much at all, so let alone like pass major legislation that would sort of change a lot of these tech platforms. You do sort of wonder if, since a lot of the people who work for these tech companies tend to have progressive values, that if at some point these very young workforces will say like they'll either quit, or it'll be harder for places like Facebook to recruit new engineers and new employees because of this. Mm-hmm. So you hope for maybe some internal change. But I do think that one of the reasons why I wanted to do this series is I think a lot of this happens on an individual level, right? Like, all of us have a role to play here in our own behavior and how we act. Like, I try to like think before I tweet now. I try to like wait 10 seconds before I fire off a tweet about something. I try to think about like, do I need to be this snarky? Is this tweet adding value? Am I persuading someone with this? I try to think like, do I need to be on my phone right now? If I'm out with friends, or if I'm seeing family, or if I'm playing with Emily and Charlie, like, do I need to be checking the phone? Do I need to really for my job? Do I need to know this piece of information, or am I just doing this out of habit? If I'm like sitting in bed, like one thing that happens is I wake up at, you know, 5:30 in the morning because Charlie starts crying and, you know, I can't sleep through that. And so, but instead of going downstairs, I like grab my phone and I just start scrolling. And I tell myself the scrolling is to catch up on the news for an hour before I go start the day. But that's not really what happens. Like, I'm just scrolling Twitter for an hour and like I didn't learn much. So now I'm trying to get out of bed, go downstairs, make coffee, sit in front of the computer, go to the New York Times, go to the Washington Post, and just read the news without the platforms to just try to educate myself and get my brain going in a different way. So I do think that there are things that we can do on an individual basis. And I think the more we're aware that we have these habits, like the easier it will be for us to change them. Because right now, I think we do it without much awareness at all.
Well, I think what you're basically saying is be more intentional and take a pause, right? I think just recognize the way that your brain has been morphed and changed by these platforms. And when you think about it like that, and you say, I'm going to intentionally not pick up my phone when I wake up in the middle of the night to get a drink of water, and I'm just going to go back to sleep instead, or you know, count back to from 30 before I pick up my phone and you'll fall back to sleep. I think that that's just a very easy thing to do. And I think it does change the way you take in news and the way you take in the world. I think that's very smart.
Well, you talked about, you said intentional, which is such exactly the right word. And like, not to get all dark, but I think part of this is I'm 40 now. Mm-hmm. And you think about mortality and you're like, okay, how do I want to spend every hour? Part of this is having children too, right?
Yes.
Like, how do I want to spend every hour of every day that I have left? You know, which is hopefully a long time, but you start thinking about it a little bit more when you hit 40 and you have a kid. And like, is the 3 hours I spent today on Twitter, was that like a good use of my time on this earth? I don't think so.
I think that you and I are both in a very similar life stage where we have young children. And so we're thinking more about the state of our world and the state of the world and all of that and how we're spending our time and micromanaging schedules and getting very few minutes of actual downtime. So I think we're in this very specific era of our lives. But I think that generally the public is in this era in which we were so addicted to every little melodrama that was happening in the news over the last, you know, half decade, because everything was so consequential. And I think we all need to break ourselves of this addiction cycle. I can't tell you, the most common conversation I have outside of how is her nap right now is like, stop freaking out about every little thing that is happening in the news. And that's not to say that things that are happening in Washington now are not important, because I think they are gravely important. And I think that they will impact all of us presently and for years to come. But we don't need to treat every single development like it's the end of the world, as we did over the last 5 years. And I think we have been so conditioned to watching cable news and checking Twitter and obsessively refreshing what's happening that we've lost the thread a little bit. And I think that we can be intentional about the way we consume our news and think about politics and think about what's happening in Washington. And this is a good moment to think about that.
Again, it goes back to, what can I change? What can I affect? And what is beyond my control? Like, we're talking as this Kyle Rittenhouse trial is happening, and I see everybody tweeting about it and everyone's very interested. And like, yeah, I'm deeply interested in the outcome of this trial. But I think about it like I think about the coverage of most trials, which is, I can't have any effect on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial.
Correct.
None of my tweets will change it. This is about the judge and the jurors and the prosecutor and the defense attorney. That's it. They will determine the shape of what happens in that trial. They will determine the outcome. And I am just a spectator. So why am I wasting my time reading a million tweets about it and stories about it? Let's just find out what happens. Then we can all react. Then we can figure out if it was a travesty of justice or not. We can all figure out what to do. But as of right now, like, there's nothing we can do. Nothing we can do.
And I think that you can be a good, informed citizen without being an obsessive Twitter scroller. And I think that over the last half decade, the line was blurred. I think that everyone was sort of in this Olympic, like an extremely long Olympic event to be the most informed citizen, because they were so helpless that information was power. And I just think we're in a different season now. It's, everything is important, and the world is still a scary place, but it's just a little bit different. And I think that the way in which we think about the internet and news and happenings around the world, the temperature needs to be put back down a little bit so that everyone lives a more sane, balanced life. It got out of hand for myself, and I think for most people that I talk to. And I think everyone can just live a happier, healthier existence without feeling like they need to know every single detail of every single thing that's happening the moment it happens.
I couldn't agree more, at least until Trump runs for president again.
Ugh, God, just the thought of it gives me such PTSD.
I can't. I don't know.
I'm immediately befriending Bezos and going to Mars. That's the only solution.
It's something that every time I catch myself thinking about it, I have to put it aside, because I'm like, again, there's nothing I can do about this now, and getting anxious over it is not going to do anything. So I just got to think about something else. Just got to think about something else.
Just don't do it. Well, I will give everyone listening to this the ultimate distraction. Go listen to Offline. It comes out every Sunday. Is that right, John?
Every Sunday.
Listen to it. I have found it so useful as I worry about all the things that you talk to. And I'm so grateful for you coming by here and giving us your wisdom and sharing all the things that you do. Everyone go listen to PodSaved America as well. And we are just so happy to have you here, John. So thank you.
Thanks for having me, Emily. This was really fun.
What a treat.
Thank you to my guest, John Favreau, and of course, my co-host, Joe Hagan. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to listen and subscribe to other 8 great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a good review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for the production work, and of course, our producer, Brett Fuchs. And thanks, of course, to our sponsors. Please support them any way you support this podcast. We will see you right here next week.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.